All right, you can see on the screen, as I said, I think last week, we're going to start really a long series of lessons on Bible characters. And so we're just going to look at various Bible characters, and there are so many good lessons that we can learn from a lot of the different characters in the Bible. In fact, all of them, there's something that we can learn from them. Some things that please God, some things that don't please God. And so it is worth our time taking a look at them. And of course, as you study the individuals, then you're studying the Bible at the same time. Their lives are told on the pages of inspiration. So we're going to be doing that for quite a while. And as you can see on the screen, we begin with Abraham. And Abraham, as you stop and think about Bible characters, he is one of the greatest Bible characters that we have. In fact, you could probably count on one hand Bible characters who are more significant than Abraham, taking, of course, deity out of the equation. We know about Jesus, about the Godhead. But of those in flesh and blood, of man, Abraham is as significant as anyone in the Bible. And you can see that in many different ways. He obviously is a very important figure to at least three religions, with the Muslims, of course, and Judaism and Christianity. We all think very highly of Abraham and point to him for a lot of different reasons. And so he's very significant. Something else that kind of points out, just from a practical standpoint, how significant he is as a Bible character, is that when you think about the first 11 chapters of Genesis covered about 2,000 years, and then the next 13 chapters, most of which cover Abraham's life, not exclusively, but most of which cover his life, those 13 chapters only cover 200 years. So You have the sacred text slowing down considerably to tell us the life of this great Bible character. But the most important thing with regard to Abraham, of course, we think about his faith, but he played a significant role in God's scheme of redemption. And that is the thing that he's, as we think about Abraham, that he is so significant. He played such a great part in that. In fact, the gospel was first preached to Abraham, you might remember. Remember from the book of Galatians, I believe it is, in Galatians chapter 3. Sure, it's in Galatians chapter 3. Let's see what Paul had to say about Paul often referred to the part of Abraham's significance that dealt with God's plan of salvation. But Galatians chapter 3. And about verse 6, it says, just as Abraham believed God, it was counted to him as righteousness. Know then that it is those of the faith who are the sons of Abraham. Even that statement shows you the significance of Abraham, that it is those of the faith who are the sons of Abraham. But look at verse 8. And the scriptures, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, in you shall all of the nations be blessed. And we'll get, of course, to that. That's a part of the call of Abraham Genesis chapter 12. But you just see how he plays that central role there with regard to God's scheme of things. And so Abraham's very, very significant. Now, one of the great things about studying Bible characters is that you see how real they are. Like, Abraham was a powerful man and a great, great faith and courageous man, but he was a man, wasn't he? So at the end of the day, even though he's the father of the faithful, as we sometimes call him, there were occasions where you could see his faith a little bit shaky. He wasn't perfect, even when it comes down to faith. There were cases, of course, Paul points out, with the sacrificing of Isaac, he didn't waver. But there, we'll see as we go from passage to passage with Abraham that, you know, there were some drop-offs and of course, being a man, He was subject to sin like everyone else. So he lied, didn't he? In fact, have you ever committed the same sin twice? You sin against God and you ask for forgiveness and you truly are repentant and you hope and you plan that you'll never do it again, and then you do it again. Well, that's the weakness of the flesh. Abraham was like that. So he was just a man. And whatever Bible character you begin to study, those are the wonderful things about the Bible. I think one of the things that really shows that the Bible is authentic is the fact that even the greatest characters in the Bible, that the Bible doesn't try to cover over their flaws. We know the flaws of David and even of Paul and Abraham and others. So to me, that says a lot about the Bible itself. But tonight we're just going to kind of do an introduction and work our way up to Abraham. And so we'll begin the very beginning. Of course, in Genesis chapter 1, we have the creation of God. And we know on the sixth day, God created man and placed Adam and Eve in the garden. And we're familiar with the fact that was a wonderful existence, a perfect paradise. No sin, of course, at all. We understand that most of the problems, if not all of the problems of life, can be traced back indirectly to the presence of sin in the world. Can you imagine being in a place where there is no sin? What does that remind you of? Where is a place you know won't be any sin? In heaven. We get to heaven. Well, it was like that in the garden for a little while. But then, of course, the devil came along and he tempted Eve, and that led to the introduction of sin into the world. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1, now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, did God actually say that you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? And it's amazing as you read some of these passages how that just sometimes when it comes to doctrine particularly, sometimes just one word makes a huge difference. You stop and think about the devil, and he does these things on purpose. He knew God's command, of course, and exactly what he instructed. But he adds, at least in the ESV here, did God actually say that you that you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? That little word "any" that makes a big difference, doesn't it? It kind of reminds me of the faith only. We're not going to talk about that tonight, but you know, I mean, sometimes you just add "only" to a passage, that changes the whole thing, doesn't it? And that's what the devil does. He's crafty like that. And of course, Eve knew what was going on. She knew exactly what God had commanded. So she responds. The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.'" And so again, she knew. She was very familiar with what God really said. You can eat of all of the, think about how generous God is. You have access to all the trees, only one you can't eat from, that tree in the midst of the garden. And so Satan comes back and he says to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God does know that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." And so when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. And so the paradise, of course, is lost. And you stop and think about what a devastating day that was when sin was introduced into the world. Yeah, go ahead, Barb. Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, it's hard to, you think about that. I guess there was no death up until that moment. But, you know, we don't have all the discussions between God and them, but she knew that was the penalty. So God must have shared that all with them. And of course, when you think about the dying part, what are the two ways of dying? Spiritual, which sin does, of course, But really, the death under consideration is physical. They would no longer have access to the tree of life. And I have to believe that God explained all that to her. So good question, though, about that. But certainly he did. They understood the threat and what the punishment would be. And of course, that came about. And so they sinned and were cast out of the garden. But what is wonderful is that here on this devastating day when sin was introduced into the world, the very day that sin was introduced, right away we have the solution to the problem, don't we? And of course, we understand that it would take a couple of thousand years for it all to come to fruition. But again, still in Genesis chapter 3, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring, and he shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. And that is, this particular passage is the first gospel, is what it is. Scholars refer to it as. I talked about the gospel being preached to Abraham, but this is the first glimpse of hope. After I hate to refer to this sin as the fall of man, because you know what that means with regard to the Calvinist in most. But now, technically, it was the fall of man, wasn't it? Because there was only two of them. So, but no, we don't inherit Adam's sin or anything like that, though. The provangelium is what that is, the first gospel. And so as we look at that, just not in great detail, the you is the devil, of course. It's not the serpent, is it? It's not the physical snake. We understand that the devil has commandeered the body of a serpent, and he's the one that is being cursed at this time. You remember, turn over to John chapter 8 and at verse 44. Someone read that. Get to that over there. We don't have to look at a whole lot of passages about that, but John chapter 8, you'll recognize the words of Jesus there. John chapter 8, verse 44. What does that remind you of? Is there any doubt but Jesus is referring to the scene in Genesis chapter 3? He is the liar. He's the very first liar, perpetrated the very first lie, and that led ultimately to the death of Adam and Eve. He's a murderer from the beginning. And so clearly, Jesus is referring to Genesis chapter 3 and talking about the serpent. Of course, Revelation chapter 12, I think it is verse 9, the devil is referred to as the ancient or old serpent. So in Genesis chapter 3, there's no doubt but that is the devil. And so I've often pointed out with Genesis 3, the devil is a real personal being, not a figment of your imagination, my imagination. He was a real being, is a real being. And of course, he would be cursed because of what he did there in the garden. The woman, obviously referring to Eve, your offspring, that would be referring to the offspring of the devil. All of those through the years who followed the devil would be his offspring. The offspring of the woman there's a sense in which you might say it's all of mankind, since she is the mother of all living, Genesis 3, verse 20. But it ultimately, of course, is referring to and is fulfilled in Christ. He's the seed or the offspring that is spoken of throughout the book of Genesis. And so what we have then with the hostility between Satan and the woman's seed, that is simply depicting the cross and what would happen on Calvary's cross. And we get this mental picture. Someone who is, maybe you get a little bit, you see a snake and you start stomping around and you finally step on the head. And your heel is bruised, but you crush the snake's head. Now, let me ask you: you'd rather have a bruised heel or a bruised head? Well, obviously, it's figurative language, but it's depicting the victory of Christ on the cross, No doubt the devil, when Jesus went to the cross, he thought he was really doing something. He thought he was gaining the victory, getting what he wanted in the death of Christ. But what was really going on was his head was being crushed. He was being destroyed. Look over at Hebrews chapter 2 and at verse, Hebrews the second chapter, and I believe it is verse 14. Hebrews chapter 2 and at verse 14. It says, "And since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself, that is Christ, likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery." And so on the cross, Jesus defeated the devil. And that's what Genesis chapter 3 is of course referring to. So we have this great messianic prophecy, but after the prophecy, things didn't really work out so great at first with mankind. You remember, turn over to Genesis chapter 4, and Cain, Adam and Eve, rather, have two sons, Cain and Abel. We're very familiar with this. Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, "I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord." And we know the story, how that they came to offer sacrifices. Who was rejected, of course? Cain was rejected. And we've often said we don't have all the pieces of the puzzle here. We don't know exactly what God commanded precisely, but because Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 4, we know that God communicated to him. And so Abel did what God told him to do, is the bottom line. And Cain decided to do his own thing, and God rejected him. And he was mad. He was so mad, he killed his brother Abel. And what a terrible situation that is, of course, one brother killing another. Look over at 1 John chapter 3, just quickly. And someone read verse 12, 1 John 3, verse 12. All right, very good. So we're told exactly why Cain did what he did. Obviously, he was full of jealousy, but the good works, the righteousness of Abel exposed his own unrighteousness. And that makes people mad. Like, that makes the world mad at you. That's why you see the very next verse there. "Do not be surprised, brothers, that the world hates you." Because that's just the response of people when your goodness will outshine theirs, and sometimes they get angry. And so we can learn a little something about that. But we have then Cain killing his brother Abel. As time goes on, Adam and Eve have another child. You remember what his name was? All right, very good. Seth comes along. And it is, as you think about it, you work your way through the early chapters of Genesis, and we don't have all of the information. And every child that was born, that sort of thing. Was Seth the third child of Adam and Eve? They usually think, oh, yeah, he was their third child. Probably not. Probably not. Because Adam and Eve are going about the business of doing what God told them to do, which was what? Right. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth. And, of course, you know, if you go back to chapter 4, and you think about what happened to Cain after he killed his brother Abel at verse 14. "Behold, you have driven me." This is Genesis 4, verse 14. "Behold, you have driven me away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden, and I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Well, who in the world was he talking about? Who was he worried about? Obviously, time has gone on, and we don't know the years and what exactly the timing at this early part of the book of Genesis. But the world is being populated, And enough people on earth that Cain thought somebody would kill him. And, of course, he marries even. It says that he, verse 17, Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And so again, the earth is being populated. But the descendants of Cain sort of follow in his steps and have the same ungodliness as he does. But there comes a time, whatever the timing is, that Seth indeed came along. And at verse 25, it says, "And Adam knew Eve, his wife, again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth, for she said, 'God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him.'" And the significance of that, the implication, is that Seth is more like Abel, a man of faith, a man who believes God, a man who no doubt believed the great messianic prophecy of Genesis 3 at verse 15. And so it goes on to say then that he had a son, Enosh, and at that time people began to call upon the name of the Lord, which sort of implies there's a whole lot, there was a time there where that wasn't going on. And so, but Seth comes along and he's like Abel, and he has influence over his family. People begin once again to call on the name of Yahweh. So he and his lineage becomes very significant. And you notice there the generations, 10 generations, that ends with Noah. But there's something significant about this line of humanity. And what do you think it is? Huh? The Messiah. That's exactly right. This is the line or the lineage of Christ. Luke chapter 3. And it stands in contrast to the descendants of Cain. Because again, Cain's lineage, they were made up of ungodly people. But Seth, the people began to call on the name of the Lord. And so you had a group of people who had faith in God and whatever that entailed way in those early years, they trusted God. And they are the sons of God. But a problem happened. Remember what happened with the sons of God? Right, right. They looked at the daughters of men. The daughters of men would be the descendants of Cain, the ungodly ones. And there would that they're just using that kind of language to depict the picture of the sons of God, the descendants of Seth, having relations with these women. There were men and women on both sides, obviously, of these lineages. But they had an attraction there, and they acted on it. So in Genesis chapter 6, at verse 1 and 2, it says, "And when man began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw the daughters of men were attractive, and they took as their wives any that they chose." And just right now, get out of your mind that this is angels cohabitating with man. That's fantasy that you sometimes hear in some commentary. That's not what this is at all. It's two lines of people, one godly, one ungodly. The descendants of Seth and the descendants of Cain. And the descendants of Seth, who were again, had godliness, they were godly, had faith about them, they made the mistake. Man often does, got carried away with the lust of the flesh, saw those descendants of Cain and were attracted to them. That ended up in intermarriage between these two groups of people. That led ultimately to earth being filled with ungodly people. And, of course, we know what comes after that. God promised to destroy the world by flood. Yeah, go ahead, Greg. No, not there at all. But you'd be surprised how many even conservative commentators come to that conclusion. And really, it's nonsense. They can't explain to you, well, why is it that the Nephilim were there after the flood, too? Wonder how that happened. But anyway, it's not that at all. But you're right. That's what they think. These are supernatural beings, a combination of man and angels. And that's not what it is at all. Just talking about the descendants of Cain and Seth. But that's what happens when, you know, you're godly and you have faith and you begin to be attracted to those who don't feel the same way you do about God. And bad things can happen. Why we always emphasize, you know, the practical things, Christians marrying Christians and that sort of thing. Because look what happened. The whole world ended up being destroyed. God promised to blot out everyone from the face of the earth because man got so wicked. Every imagination, every thought of the heart became only evil continually. And so then we have, obviously, the flood in chapter 6, 7, and 8, we read about the flood. Fortunately, Noah found grace in the eyes of God, and that stopped man from being completely obliterated. And so he and his family got on the ark, and they were spared, and they were able then to repopulate the earth. Jumping ahead to Genesis chapter 9, verse 18 and 19, the sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. And so, now, think you're related to these people? How many of you think you're related to one of these guys? All of them. You know, one of the things that you think about Noah and all of that. You think about this crazy world and which we live, and people looking down on others because of whatever it might be, color or different language. Yeah, let me just tell you right now, if the person who is prejudiced is dumber than rocks when you stop and think about that. Because guess what? We're all connected. Every single one of us are connected. Whatever color your skin, whatever language you speak. One of the great passages, I think, in all of the Bible is when Paul was speaking to the Athenians. Remember in Acts chapter 17? Look over there just for a second. And you might, verse 26, I think it was Ken Ham, the fellow with, you know, the ark and the museum and all, dinosaur. He's great on evidences and that sort of thing. He has several good books. He can't do a thing with God's plan of salvation. It's amazing. But he's brilliant when it comes down to evidences and things. But he has a book titled after this particular verse. And notice it says that, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. And I think the King James says one blood. We all have the same blood. No matter who you are. And so isn't it ridiculous? People think, well, this group over here, well, they're not just as smart as we are over here. That's just stupidity at the highest height. Because the fact of the matter is, we're all related. We're all connected. One blood, one man out of all nations from one man. And that points back, that goes all the way back to this, of course. So now the significance of this. You have his sons. They survive. 8 people on the ark, of course. They all come out. But of his 3 sons, it is Shem who is the significant one because he's in that lineage. He's in the lineage. It was from him that ultimately the Savior would come. But look down the very end of it. Who's there but Abraham? So Abraham is a descendant of Shem. And all of these generations are told, this is Genesis 11, 10 through 26. And if you want to make a mention, we're not studying the book of Genesis per se, but you can divide up the book of Genesis nicely into all the passages that talk about the generations. These are the generations. There's 10 of them. The Toletoth is what the Hebrews call that. And there's 10 of them. They all begin. These are the generations of the heaven and the earth. These are the generations of Adam. These are the generations of Noah. And so on. and there's 10 of them. And that's what these lists are. But Abraham, he came from Shem. And so he is, of course, an ancestor of Christ. But that takes us then to Genesis chapter 11. And at verse 27, we are introduced to Abraham. So let's go to that particular passage. Genesis chapter 11, that kind of tells the story up to Abraham. But then, remember all of those passages and all that we just covered. That's more Bible than I think I've ever covered any time. I just covered 2,000 years of things right then. That's pretty good, wasn't it? But it's about to slow down. And so at chapter 11, at verse 27, Abraham's mentioned at verse 26, but really, beginning at verse 27, we see the background of Abraham. Now, these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abraham and Nahor and Haran fathered Lot. And Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abraham's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah. And this is kind of interesting. The daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now, Sarai was barren. She had no children. And so you can't really get all bogged down with the relations in those early days with the, you know, people have asked, where'd Cain get his wife? Who'd he marry? And you've heard it before. You know, some say, well, he got his wife from his father-in-law. But exactly who was his wife? Well, obviously, he married his sister, maybe his niece, because we don't know how much time passed, that sort of thing. And so what you read here isn't really all that strange in those early years. But a couple of things very quickly with regard to these early verses. Abraham came from an idolatrous people. And no doubt reason for God calling him out and to go into a place that he did not know. Look over at Joshua 24. Very quickly, Joshua chapter 24. And we don't have a lot of time left. We'll get in more into the meat of his life starting next week. But Joshua chapter 24, and I'm thinking verse 2 is where it says, and Joshua said to all of the people, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, long ago your father lived beyond the Euphrates, Terah, the father of Abraham and of Nahor, and they served other gods. And then I took your father Abraham from beyond the river and led him through all of the land of Canaan. So Abraham's family worshiped other gods. Was Abraham involved in that? Not ever told whether he was or not. I like to think he rose above that. But he was definitely from a family that served other gods. And was that the reason why God wanted him to leave and go into another place? You know, 1 Corinthians 15 tells us that bad company ruins good morals. And it would have been awful hard for Abraham to be all that he was and to do what he ended up doing, surrounded by family particularly that were idolatrous. Like, it's not like, you know, you think, yeah, well, why would God call him then if that was really a problem? He sent him into a land surrounded by people who committed idolatry. Yes, but isn't it different with family? It's hard to overcome family. And so there he is. He needed a separation from family. And so, again, Joshua. And then, just to point out in passing, Ur was where Abraham received his original call. And keep that in mind, because as we get to chapter 12, it sounds like God is calling Abraham from Haran. But that wasn't the case at all. He was just repeating the call. We know from Stephen in Acts chapter 7 at verse 2. And Stephen said, "Brothers and fathers, hear me. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he lived in Haran. And said to him, go out from your land and from your kindred and go into a land that I will show you." And then he went out from the land of the Chaldeans and lived in Haran. And after his father died, God removed him there into the land in which you are now living. And so when he got that call, he was still in Mesopotamia. And now a couple of things. The bell's about to ring, but you know, for years I've read things about Abraham, and that this shows some of the weakness of Abraham. And make no mistake about it, we're going to see weakness on the part of Abraham. But I'm not sure. A lot of people think that, like, he didn't quite do what God told him to do because he didn't leave his kindred completely. Who did he take with him? Lot. And, of course, that, you know, at the end of the day, that was kind of a mess. He would have been a lot better off leaving Lot behind. Don't you think? Now, he got into a war over Lot. His herdsmen and his, they fought. And, of course, ultimately, you know, the Moabites and the Ammonites came from Lot. Those people gave the Israelites trouble throughout their history. And so, you know, he probably would have been better off leaving. But I don't know that Abraham sinned against God in any way by taking Lot with him. I think some are a little too hard in this place on Abraham. At least I don't read of anything in the Bible where God is upset with the fact that he took. In fact, next week we'll look, when you look at Genesis 11, I think it's verse 32, the last verse there. It might be 31, but anyway, it seems to me like that really was decided by Terah and not Abraham. And Terah was the one at that point was in charge. He was the father, wasn't he? And so we'll read that and talk about that on next week. And we'll really get more into the life of Abraham himself.